I'd like to call to order the Senate Education and General Government Committee, and I would like to open a public hearing on SB 7. Ms. Richardson, would you like to go through that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SB 7 directs the Oregon 529 College Savings Board to establish a prepaid tuition plan. It limits tuition changes in accordance with projected rates that are adopted by the board, requires the board to contract for insurance, guaranteeing a projected rate of return for funds invested by account holders, and it limits eligibility for prepaid tuition contracts to those who are 13 years of age or younger upon the date contracts are first made available.
Okay. And we have Senate President Courtney, State Treasurer Ben Westlin, and Representative Stigler with us today. If you three want to come up kind of as a panel.
Mr. Chair, if Westland's going to testify, I can't support the bill. That's just it. So,
surprised you didn't pick the bill.
Chair. This doesn't have much of a sense of humor.
I don't know how to rank whoever wants to.
We'll go that way.
You're the man.
Before eight.
No, he's the man. Go with the State Treasurer first.
We'll go with Brain.
Mr. Treasurer.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, State Treasurer Ben Westland. I am here to testify in strong support of the bill under consideration, the Prepaid Tuition Plan Oregon College Guarantee Act. Just as a little history, I became chairman of Oregon's 529 College Savings Plan in January. Our goal was then and remains today steadfastly to make this the best 529 plan in the country. And in simplest terms, one of the strategies to do that means making more options available, have more accountability, and for those who are risk averse, creating more certainty in their college savings plans. And that's what a prepaid tuition option added to the existing 529 plan would certainly do. It would equal peace of mind for a certain segment of college savers. In these turbulent times, not just Oregonians, but certainly all are looking for the assurance that their hard-earned college savings money is going to be there when they need it most. That equates to affordability and access as costs continue to rise. You know, the nature and the culture of savings is that most families cannot afford to write a check for their college education all at one time. You know, our job is to provide more options in an economic world that is changing, and we need to change to meet the needs of those families. And the bottom line is that this is a complement to the existing 529 plan. It is covered under the Internal Revenue Code that bears the number of the 529 section of the 529 tax code. This is an important option. It's one of those that must be done right, and it is one of those that we in this body, as a deliberative institution, you know, have the capacity to make this not only a proper addition, but our 529 College Savings Plan the best in the country. I hope you will share with me in that journey and our efforts to do just exactly that. I'd be happy to answer any questions, probably perhaps after the others have testified.
Thank you.
You're next.
Does that mean good?
He says you're next. You're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Judy Stigler, representative from District 54 in the center of the state, City of Bend, mostly. At any rate, some weeks ago, Treasurer Westland approached me to be a co-sponsor, co-chief sponsor of this piece of legislation. And after sitting down with him and his staff and reviewing both the goal and purpose of this piece of legislation, I was happy to sign on. And I'm not going to talk about any of the technical aspects of this. You've got plenty of people here with more brain power than me to address those issues. I'm coming at this from a personal perspective. I'm a product of the Oregon University system, or Oregon higher ed system, back in the day when it had a robust student support system where there were not a plentiful supply, but there was a more robust supply of college opportunities through various programs, including the Oregon State Scholarship Program. And I was fortunate because I came from a situation where my parents didn't have the ability to put away any money for a college education. And if it was going to happen, it was going to happen because somebody else saw that I should have that opportunity, and that came in that in the form of both work-study programs that were available as well as the state scholarship program that was available back in the day. So I was a beneficiary of some what I consider very unique planning and very foresightedness on the part of past generations of Oregonians. I see this as sort of the next iteration of that. I'm now a proud grandparent of a six-month-old baby granddaughter, and I watch as my son and daughter-in-law from the very get-go started talking about putting money away for her college education. I have two children who have graduated from private universities and schools. I know what the cost is. I know what the predicaments are that parents can find themselves in. One of the first things my son told me was, "Mom, rather than send us a lot of frou-frou stuff, which we don't have room for, put some money in a 529 plan." And I see this as another option available to parents, to grandparents, to people who are interested in our next generation of students and educating our next generations of citizens of this state. It's one more tool in the toolkit, one more arrow in the arsenal, however you want to classify it. It's another option out there for folks to be able to put some security in place for that day when their children are eligible to go off to college in this state. And I think we need to do, as we've struggled over the last couple of decades in this state with trying to put some, some meat on the bones of our state support system for our students. I see this as an opportunity. This is part of that triumvirate of state responsibility, parental responsibility, and student responsibility for going, you know, the next steps in our educational process. And I just see this as a very unique opportunity to provide, as I said, another element in the toolkit for affordability, access, and opportunity. So that's why I'm behind this fellow in bringing this before you. And I know that there are some, I've talked with other members of the House, with folks involved in both the community college and university systems, some concerns they have. I'm confident that we can work out the technical fixes that we need to be able to put this in place as a very robust, meaningful plan. So thank you for this opportunity today.
Thank you.
President. My name is Peter Courtney, and I live at 2925 Island View Drive North here in Salem. I'm a state senator, District 11. I come here today to support Senate Bill 10 with the other sponsors, Representative Judy Stigler and the State Treasurer Ben Weston. As has been said, this bill established a prepaid tuition plan to help Oregon families pay for college. You have my written statement, but just for the record, the cost of college education continues to rise. I understand these figures are fairly recent, $5,700 tuition at Southern, up to $6,400 at University of Oregon. Average cost in your public, you have eight public universities in the state, is somewhere in the neighborhood of $6,130. That $6,400 of U of O does not include the $150 boost. They just got permission from last week in the Board of Higher Education for the spring term. They're going to increase their tuition for the spring term, $150 per in-state student and $350 per out-of-state students. The cost has increased 6.5% a year since 1997, and the average cost of room and board and other expenses is an additional $13,000. We estimate that if you get a degree from one of the eight universities in the state of Oregon that are public, I'm not talking private, the cost of that is $76,000 over 4 years. I'm not going to talk to you today about Willamette across the street or your Linfields or your Pacifics or your Lewis and Clarks or Reed. I am very familiar as well as them. You're talking in the neighborhood of at least some of them $41,000 to $43,000 to $44,000 a year to go to those schools. We have made improvements in the recent years in the availability for opportunity grants, but our students are still too often overburdened by debt when they graduate from college. The Oregon University system is telling us that the average debt upon graduation is $20,000. That figure, I think, is way low. I think the national figures is $24,000. I have to just tell you that figure is low. I think most students that I'm familiar with are carrying debt somewhere in the neighborhood of $30,000 or $40,000 when they come out of college or universities. That's the undergraduate degree. That does not include the graduate degree. Yet our need for the value of a college education has never been higher. Now, I know a little bit about this. As you know, I'm pretty old. Just got married late in life, and that explains. We have three sons. Peter, our oldest, graduated from Western Oregon in 2004. My middle son, who you somewhat know about as a result of the last 2 days, will graduate in May from Carroll College in Montana. And our youngest, our baby, is a junior at Arizona State University in Tempe, Arizona. So this thing about going to college is something I have had experienced personally, my wife and I. And we know a little bit about the whole situation. Most families simply can't afford college. They cannot afford to send their kids to school. So their kids are going to go begging for either scholarships, grants, or loans. And loans, to me, are dangerous. I had a long discussion with my middle son yesterday. I know what he's going to come out of Carroll with is $10,000. I want to draw it down, but he wants to pay for it. $10,000 out of Carroll College is really not a lot of debt. But even though you can get a lot of loans, loans create tremendous debt for that young man or woman when they graduate on graduation day. So loans are one thing. Grants are more hard to come by. Scholarships, you know, there's all kinds of scholarships. But the competition is unbelievable. This program hopes to make the college more affordable to Oregon families. Number two, the plan has some tax advantages, and you have my written statement. I won't get into detail. It also, most importantly, allows for security. But the beauty of the plan is that, you know, everybody talks about parents, but there are grandparents, and there's aunt and uncles, and there's just friends. You know, I have to say to you, and I'm going to say something that's outrageous. When I coached at the Boys and Girls Club out here, every team I ever coached, every young man was usually raised by an aunt or uncle or a grandparent, to be very frank with you. The parents were not there. They didn't have parents. Other parents had left them. They stayed in two or three different homes. And I can honestly see a big brother or sister, and I don't know, you may think it's an exaggeration, as a Christmas present or something, or a birthday present, actually making a down payment on prepaid tuition is an extraordinary gift to a very young boy or girl to make sure that young boy or girl understood that they were going to go to college. So this is much more than just parents coming up with a way to make sure their daughter or son. This extends to all of us adults who feel that we have an obligation to make sure that the younger generation gets a shot at some things that we as a minimum had, as well as an opportunity for education. You know, 1997, Frank Morris, and if Senator Cruz were here, I would say this was a very bad year for me. That was the year I introduced PKU, and I at least got it through the legislature, and we finally just approved it finally after all the sunsets. But it's the year I worked with then Bill, Representative Bill Markham, a very conservative Republican out of Riddle, if you ever heard of Riddle. And we put together prepaid tuition. And I didn't realize it. I knew we got it through the Senate and the House. One vote for the House was 41-5, and to the Senate was 21-7. You do understand that I was very much a minority then. The Republicans controlled both houses. But we got it through. We had to go on the ballot. I don't want to know why we had to go on the ballot. And we lost it on the ballot for reasons I don't want to go into here. Otherwise, you'd have prepaid tuition today. And I'll just make a statement to you. If we had prepaid tuition today, as a result of 1997, those families who recently lost some of their college savings to market downtown while their student was in or just about to go to college would have been protected. They would have been protected regardless of where the economy is had we gotten it done in 1997. We didn't. The parents, the people rejected it. It's my understanding that this thing has been written in such a way, and I'm not a legal expert, so don't push me on that. It does not need to go on the ballot, this one. This is some other kind of brand of this. So I'm a big fan of prepaid tuition. I'm back again trying to make up for my sins of 1997. And as I say, I'll do anything to give a parent, or more importantly, a young man or a young woman, or a non-traditional student, I might even add. As you know, the average age of people in college or universities would really surprise you, the average age. We all think everybody coming out when they're 18 is going. Nowadays, that is dramatically changing, and in fact, it's being encouraged by many public and private college and university. Do not go to college right off the bat. Take at least a year off. And I'm talking about such schools as Harvard, Yale, and the Ivies and them. So I think it's a good program. We got to be careful how we structure it. That's why you got the state treasurer here and all these gurus behind me who say they know how to do this stuff. But I know one thing. It's as good as what we got, and I'm not going to get into how I feel about what we got. So I hope that you were good enough to let me come here and present this. You were good enough, Mr. Chair, to even schedule a public hearing on it. And maybe you'll be good enough to even see if you're willing to work it. Thank you for letting me come here today and testify.
Thank you, all three. On the idea of getting grandparents to put money into account as opposed to buying something cute and fluffy and pink, good luck with that one.
Yeah, I still buy the cute, fluffy, and pink, I assure you.
Any questions of our panel? Representative Lipscomb?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have some questions, and if these are questions that you can't answer and there's other people, I don't know who else is going to be coming up certifiably smart to answer about some of these, so feel free to defer those. But first of all, I'd say I really commend you for bringing this forward. It's definitely the right idea, and I hope you'll be able to enact this into law. I just have some technical questions, though, about the legislation itself. On page 2 in section 2, sub 4, and I see this all the time with things relating to higher ed, these contracts are exempted from public contracting codes, ORS 279A and 279B. Can you tell me why they would be exempted from those parts of the public contracting code? This is for the insurance carrier for the product. And if someone else, that's okay, but I want to answer that question.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger again for the record, State Treasurer Ben Westland. One of the structures that we anticipate, that if this bill is passed, we are not going to immediately implement this. There will be at least a year and a half, 2 year period to construct the actual relationship between the state and the managers of this, quote, product. So it's going to be very complicated, very intricate, and it would be pretty hard to imagine that a multiple of contractors and providers would be willing to bid on what's really a narrow piece of business. This, at the end of the day, the corpus in this insurance fund will not be that large by standards, of various investment banking houses, insurance companies. So, we're going to target it to our needs and then, get the best provider that can meet those needs. We do have certified smart people behind us that can more articulately express that kernel of the wisdom as to why it is, quote, exempt.
Okay.
You don't go buy these things off the shelf.
Yeah. Well, I'd appreciate that. And I'll wait for some, further explanation on that, because especially with your comment that it will take a while to put this together, so it seems like we could use our normal public contracting process and that it's not something that's going to happen tomorrow. So that's just one point. Second point is addressing the solvency of the program. In Section 5, it says that the board at any time, that if the insurance required under Section 2 cannot be purchased or terminates, the board can close the program to new contracts and may cancel existing contracts. And so I guess my question there is, when we're trying to provide certainty for students and say you could 16 years down the road that contract can be canceled, I just wonder if that provides the certainty. I understand what you're trying to get at, but I wonder if there's a way we should strengthen that somehow the state's going to stand behind this. Someone's been in the program 16 years and there's kids ready to go to college, that the contract all of a sudden is canceled. The second part of that on that same line is also to ensure solvency, quote, may take any other action. And I just wonder, the board may take any other action. And could that possibly mean raising the tuition that was guaranteed in order to still go to college? I just think for clarity that might be able to be strengthened so that we make sure as many people participate in it.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to make a statement. This will get me in trouble. I don't like the language you first read at all. That's how I'm going to say it. I don't care what the experts say behind me, because I don't want a cancellation, because you're absolutely right. This is a part of security. I mean, a young boy or girl, regardless of their age, are going to be able to know whatever happens, they're going to go to college. So that's a given. Otherwise, let's not do this. As far as other options, that doesn't frighten me as much. But the first language you read, and it's extended in here, and I'm not conversant with every doggone word in this thing, that bothers me greatly. So I'm just going to say that for the record, State Treasurer, as well as for the record, because I'm glad you're asking these very aggressive, tough questions, because I want to make sure the bottom line is that when a person buys these things, and that kid's there, regardless of their age, because they're not going to be as conversant with it, what's going on, that when it's time for them to go to school, they don't have to worry. They're going to get their shot based on this.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I had one follow-up, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that, Senator Courtney, and I know that's where we all want to go, because I think about PERS, you know, if we lose the money, we still have to pay it. You know, the state's obligated. And I just want to make sure that when we go out to families, we're saying this is the rate and we're going to guarantee it. And the final one is, and again, this may be one of the experts coming up, so I'm throwing the question out, that is, you know, we have the opportunity grant, and, you know, we've expanded that. It's not meeting everything we want, but we're doing better with that. And that's generally targeted at people who can't perhaps otherwise go to college without this scholarship type assistance because of their income level, et cetera. And I would be interested in any of the future witnesses who've been really in-depth in this particular program could comment on the fact that I wouldn't want our tuition program, which, you know, people are saving, are usually people who don't know they would have the money otherwise, so they're saving for their child or their grandchild, and then not be eligible for other scholarships because they say, oh, you have a prepaid tuition, even though you've been kind of, you know, you're a lower income family, and you might otherwise have qualified for other scholarships to attend an OUS, but now that you have this, you don't have it. So in other words, it's counterproductive to, and I was just wondering if you could still qualify for scholarships based on income level if you have a prepaid tuition, or whether this negates that ability. That's just another question I had.
But Chair, all I can tell you, and I'm a middle-income person, and you can say, well, you should only have so many children and you should space your children. But let's face it, I have two children in school and college at the same time. We looked under every rock. We're looking every place we can get it. And I'm not, because of certain incomes, I can't get the same thing and get other incomes. You will look for every, you will spend days, months, and years combing through every possible way because of the magnitude. These are just sheer numbers. We didn't talk about travel and other ancillary experience. You can't tell a kid he can't do anything at college. So the magnitude of the debt is so extraordinary. It's increasing at such an extraordinary rate that, you know, I don't know where opportunity grants will be when it's time for this boy or girl to go to college, but I'll tell you this much. If most of their tuition is paid for, at least at the public universities of the state of Oregon, that is a peace of mind for somebody in their life, and I think that's the most important thing to acknowledge. Opportunity grants, you know, that's subject to the whim of the legislature, and I don't mean to be disrespectful. It's subject to the whim of how we make arbitrary decisions about who among all of us can afford to send a kid to college. You know, you never know where one of your kids are going to choose to go to college. I mean, I told my three boys, if you're interested, I did not require them to go to a public university. I said, wherever you go, no matter how much it costs, I will kill my sake, take four jobs if you get a shot to go to a school that's expensive. That's just the way I felt about it. Others may not feel the same way about it. So anything you can do along these lines so a parent from the day that child is born to starts putting away money to pay for some kind of college, I think is a good idea given how we have yet, we talk about health care cost control, we have no control costs right now over higher education or education beyond high school, none at all. I have 10 years in college, 3 degrees. Are you kidding me? Today I couldn't have done that. Today, I could not have done. I came out $10,000 in debt when I came out of law school, bachelor's, master's. Today, I'd have been afraid to try any of that because I had my parents, they had tremendous illness, my mother. So I'm just saying, this thing is exploding. And what we're trying to do here, Senator Metzger, is offer another significant option from the moment of birth that parents can have faith in something. At least here is some tuition credits at these schools in Oregon, my Oregon. I guess they're transferable too and all that. You can get into all that stuff.
My final comment, Mr. Chair, if you would indulge me, and I appreciate that, and I'm absolutely 100% in agreement with you, Senator. I was just thinking, and this doesn't necessarily have to be in this legislation, but I think it would be very helpful, if at least our OUS system, that when these kids get to college and they have a prepaid tuition, that somehow this particular plan is not used as a negative in their qualification for other grants or opportunities to attend, you know, that particular system. So, you know, it's that would be a good thing for our university system to make sure that if they would qualify for something else but for that tuition grant, they should still be able to get that to help complete. So that's just an observation and doesn't necessarily have to be done in this bill, but I think that would be important.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Chair Hass. And this is following up a bit on Senator Metzger's last comment, and I want to preface this by saying that my college experience was very much like yours, Representative Stiegler, and that I worked all the way through college and through law school, and had a combination of grants and work study and working at a job. So I've been there, and I appreciate that, and I also have a lot of empathy for President Courtney because I have one child in a private college and another one going to a private college. So I'm very much aware of the costs. And my concern, I want to talk about the policy issue, because we have the 529 plan, and this is creating another alternative, and I very much appreciate the need for this. But what I want to talk about is related to what Senator Metzger said, because he said we don't want this to count as a negative if there were for other opportunities that they have later. I want you to address, please, the issue of families who can't save. They're just barely making it right now, and they can't afford to save, so that when their children are entering college, they're paying more tuition than the family who now is able to save. So as much as I appreciate this, I want to be able to address that issue of we're creating a two-tiered system then for people who really can't afford to save now. Their children are going to be paying more tuition than the people who can afford to save now who are locking in a lower tuition rate. So maybe that's a policy choice that we're being asked to make, but I'd like you to address whether it's something, how do we get there by creating a system that's more expensive for a low-income family to send their child to school than a family who can afford to save?
If I may, Ms. Chair, Senator Bonamici, if I may speak bluntly, this is not a perfect bill yet. We certainly don't live in a perfect world. And what this bill really represents, and the 529, the existing 529 College Savings Plan, what this really represents is our failure, and I include myself in this, our failure as public policymakers to, on a broader, deeper, and more comprehensive level, to address the funding of higher education throughout this state for decades. This is a much larger fundamental issue than this bill addresses. So what this is a, that's quite honestly, and don't get me wrong, I am entirely supportive because it does address and solve part of the problem. But it doesn't solve all the problem. So what this is really is the good old American way. We treat the symptom. We don't treat the root causes. So that's a much larger, much deeper, and actually much more important conversation than this bill attempts to address. That's the fundamental reason we're sitting here and the supporters of this bill are sitting here, is to do what we can now under current circumstances. But I look forward to joining you in that effort and conversation, because it's fundamental to Oregon's future.
Well, Chair, it's a very painful question. If I had my druthers, just Peter, every boy or girl came out of one of our high schools that met the qualification for graduation, had a certain GPA, and wanted to go to a public university in the state of Oregon, just that they would not have to worry about their tuition. I'm just going to say it straight up. That's my philosophy. That's my attitude. And that's just how I feel. But I make no bones about it. I'm not sad about saying that. I think it should be absolutely there. I don't believe every boy and girl should go to necessarily a four-year institution, be it a community college, that everybody needs to get beyond some degree. They need to go get some education beyond a high school level. Community college, however you want to call it, and I think the tuition should be handled. I just will say it to you. But that doesn't make it happen. So I think that's where you want me to go, or at least that's the question, and that's my basic philosophical position about education beyond the high school level for all young men and women who come out of our high schools.
I believe that's what they do in Ireland, Mr. President.
And look at Ireland.
I appreciate that candor, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for missing the majority of the testimony. The Oregonian was calling. My wife lived in Florida for 10 years, and Florida has a prepaid tuition plan, which she bought into and was fully vested in. In that plan, and then she made the biggest mistake of her life and married me. And
I don't like the way this is going.
Mr. President, you probably would agree with that assessment. But the point is, so she moved to Oregon, and Florida is honoring what was paid in Florida by contributing, because we have a daughter who's a sophomore at U of O. They are honoring their commitment by contributing the cost of tuition in Florida to her education in Oregon, and for one semester she is at Arizona State. They did the same there. And I'm reading the language in this bill, and because it's fairly clear on the state institutions, it's saying you're going to do something by rule on non-state institutions, which I'm assuming could be higher ed institutions in other states or private universities inside the state. So I'm just kind of wondering how those other institutions are going to be impacted by this and why it isn't more explicit and subject to rule.
At what cost? I know the answer, but go ahead. You want to take it? I'll tell you.
Let me give you a short answer and then allow all of us in the committee to have the privilege of asking that question to Certified Smart has done this. We have with us today the administrator of Washington State's prepaid tuition plan, who's run this very successfully for a number of years, and if I could point out, is graciously and generously here on her own time and her own dime because she believes so strongly. And there is an interoperability portion to most of these plans. They're not all exactly the same, but I think that's a key component, Senator Cruz.
Senator Cruz, this is true in 97 when Bill Markman and I put the bill together, and it's true today. Our intention is to do what Florida does. They'll be transferred out of state. That's the intention. I don't have the actual what it is, how the transfer goes, but they would be transferable out of state institutions. So that's what our intention is. It is, and that's what our intention was in 97. Senator Representative Mark and I put the bill together.
Well, Mr. Chair, and I remember I was here in 97,
right.
And I supported it in 97.
Right. So that's the intention.
Yeah. Okay. The language in the bill was a little bit vague on when it says we'll establish rules. It concerns me. Okay.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Courtney, there's a subject that was raised here that I'd love to spend some time on, and that's how do we solve at a root cause level the very issue that was raised. But that's a subject for a different day. In fact, it's tomorrow at 1 o'clock in Revenue, Mr. President. And it will go a long way towards solving this, and that's looking thoughtfully at how we create a constitutionally dedicated rainy day fund so we don't have the stress that we're putting into the system today. So, Mr. President, I appreciate that opportunity to put in that that pitch. But my question is of
a shameless plug.
is of a bit of a granular nature. If we enter into a prepaid tuition contract and we match that with an insurance product that it makes an assumption for a rate of inflation, what happens when that rate of inflation drastically exceeds that guaranteed insurance income? Who picks up the gap in that circumstance?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, if I may, the way this is currently designed, and it's, don't misunderstand me, and I again ask questions to the more technically knowledgeable individuals behind us, but you enter this program, I buy X amount of credits for my child or grandchild, that pool is set, your rate is set, your ability to purchase X amount of credits 5, 7, 10, 12, 15 years in the future is set. As we go forward, there will be a advisory committee, a rate-setting board, that based on the 10-year rolling average of tuition increases, they will look at the premium paid by everyone as they enter the program and adjust that premium. Could be up, could be down. But there will be an ongoing rate-setting mechanism that allows for, if the original actuarial assumptions do not prove to be exactly correct. And that could be beneficial, or it could cost, you know, some additional dollars. That's as literate as I can be on.
Well, I'm going to get in trouble. Chair Hassan, I thought it's did I sign on to the bill? This other conversation you want to have about life. I just asked, did I sign on to the bill?
I don't know.
I think I did. Just so
thank
I know you.
You
want to have this conversation about life, but I think you'll see my name on it.
Will you appear tomorrow at 1 o'clock?
I don't know how to say this. If the world ends, we're all in trouble. And I'm not trying to be disrespectful. I mean, I'm on PERS. There's no such thing as security. All we got is death and taxes. I am going to die. Don't want to, but I'm going to die. And I'm going to pay taxes. So what I'm saying is, it's to my understanding, and I'm just dealing with my staff who knows more than I do about life. They better be telling this right. The bottom line is the kid is not going to be left without what we said we were going to give the kid. Now, if the world ends, if you understand economic and collapses, well, we're not even going to, everything's going to pieces. So I don't know what kind of guarantee you want me to say is going to be there, Senator Morris, but our intention is to have a whole lot more guarantee than we have the college savings plan right now. And we have 19 states doing this, and I'm dying to have some of the experts in the past in the back come up and start answering these very difficult questions for me, as well as Washington's representatives here, because they have had this for some period of time now. So I don't know. I'll be frank with you. We didn't put this. This is not designed to go on the ballot. The reason we put it on the ballot was to guarantee the full faith and credit of the state of Oregon. That was part of the measure when we passed it in 97. I'll just be frank with you. Remember that, Senator? That was it. If you know what I'm saying. And it went down. Now, it went down for some reason. I'll get in trouble if I talk about them here. But it shouldn't have gone down, but it went down. But that was there for that reason. And, in fact, that would have answered your question. Query then, Peter. You're not asking to put it in the ballot now, which I understand I'm not. I've been told it's not necessary. So this committee, because you're all, I put this committee together, wow. You need to, I welcome you getting into these very difficult questions for me, very important discussions to make sure that when we say to that young man or woman, your tuition is paid for, at least this much is paid for, they don't have to worry about that. And we are going to take care of it. So that's all I'm going to say for the record, Mr. State Treasurer. I'm not trying to mess you up, but I need to put some of this stuff on the record because I'm heavily involved in this thing starting back in 1997.
Okay. Well, thank you all three. You all, by the way, too, have a letter, I think, from the Chancellor who raises some of these very same concerns we're talking about.
We had a talk with him in his office one day, and I thought we had him squared around. Is he going to talk for what? We did. We didn't try to sneak up on higher ed on this thing at all.
Well, he didn't say he's opposed. He just wants to address some of these concerns and a larger concern on that the things will continue to get worse and worse and worse for university funding instead of turning in that direction that we all hope we can go, and which, frankly, we're trying to work on in a couple of bills in this committee. So you have that, and we'll work in those concerns as we move forward.
If I may, Mr. Chair, I believe the accurate characterization of that letter, and this is, again, a great deal of collaboration working with, quite frankly, still some I's to dot T's to cross, but OUS's original position was quite concerned, and they have moved from quite concerned to, as I would characterize that letter, neutral to tipping positive. I think that's a fair characterization. I need to describe someone else's letter, but that's because
I would say somewhat concerned, but not as much.
Senator Cruz, it is always good to see you, sir. Thank you.
All right, we have a few more witnesses on this bill, then we're going to get to PE and conditioning. I do want to call up Mrs. Lochner from the state of Washington, who's here from more than 100 miles, and we try to give priority. In fact, why don't Michael Parker, if you want to join her, and Phil, if you want to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Michael Parker, Executive Director of the 529 College Savings Network. It might be, and I got a really, actually, a very quick PowerPoint that kind of goes through how the program would work. And then Betty Lochner, as Treasurer Wetzel mentioned, was nice enough to come down and give her perspective on their program. So I thought maybe I would address a couple of the questions that were asked so we don't forget to get those addressed. Mr. Chair,
Michael, I think that's a good plan. If you could be sensitive to our time,
yes.
Another bill. We need to start soon.
Sure, I will go very quickly. Regarding the public contracting code question, I Treasurer Weston, I think, almost hit it, but I think the situation there is, given the fact that we have to structure an investment product, you're going to want to have the flexibility to take the best one, not necessarily the cheapest one. And I think that's why the contracting code is exempted at that point. So you want to be able to take the best product to meet our investors' needs, not just necessarily the cheapest one that might be out there. Like that addresses that question. I think more importantly, though, the question about the board being able to cancel contracts. And you addressed this at the end with Senator Courtney. Because the program is not backed by the full faith and credit of the state, the board has to have the latitude if the program becomes insolvent to do something about that. If it went to the ballot and the state says we're going to back it up with the full faith and credit, then that would not be the case. But because we're not backing it up with that pledge, and we would have a very serious financial issue come up, the board has to have the ability to do something to protect the solvency of the plan. So that addresses that question. And then the other question was, would this hurt the ability to get, you know, to get financial aid or other scholarships for those folks saving? The answer is no. Really, this program is considered a parental asset. And so on the FAFSA form, when you fill out the FAFSA form, if you had the pleasure of doing that, it goes as a parental asset, which is calculated a much, much smaller asset than the student's asset. And actually, Betty can address some of those in the GEP program. And I can address additional questions after the presentation. So I have a very quick PowerPoint that just addresses how this program would work here. And it's graphical in nature because I'm kind of a graphic learner, and hopefully folks are as well. So prepaid tuition plans, like all college savings plans, really, they start with the families and the students. That's what we're doing this for, as you heard from the last panel. This chart is going to show how the flow of money would work and how flow of education would work in this program. And as mentioned before, prepaid tuition plans have been around, you know, since the 1980s. Florida, I think Florida, Michigan, the two biggest plans in the country, have been around a long time, very successful programs. The beauty of this program in this state is that this prepaid plan would work in concert with the savings plan. So you can use prepaid tuition for tuition and fees. You can use the savings plan for room and board and other expenses. So that's a bit, they work actually in concert with each other. So I'm just going to walk through graphically how it would work, and I'll do it very quickly, Senator Haas. Basically what happens is that families purchase tuition at today's price plus a small premium. That premium pays for the administration of the program, and it pays for this guarantee or this insurance piece that we're putting around the program. The money is then funneled into the 529 trust, and the trust invests that money with specific guidelines. If we're putting the guarantee around, which we'll talk about in a second, there's going to be guidelines how that money needs to be invested. And I think, as Betty can touch on, families can buy tuition in several ways. They can buy it in a lump sum. They can say, I want to buy 4 years worth of tuition today, and they can put that down and lock in that rate. They can do a pay-as-you-go system, which I think a lot of families might do. When I have the extra money, I'm going to buy some credits this year. I can't do it the year after, but I can do it, you know, in 5 years, I'll buy some more credits. So it's a pay-as-you-go system. Or the other way, which is actually quite interesting, is they can actually contract with us and finance the cost for 4 years. So what that means, think about buying a car. They can say, I want to buy 4 years worth of college. How much does that cost me per month? We'll calculate that based on a financed rate, and they can pay us per month and lock in the rate. There is a finance charge, just like there is when you buy a car, but then you can lock in that rate. And actually, Betty, I think, speak to that as well. So that's how the money comes in, where it goes, and how you can buy tuition credits. Again, I'm going to go quickly just because I know you're mindful of your time. So the second piece then is, obviously, when the student is ready to go, they receive tuition at the time of enrollment. Again, they do not receive cash. I know that question about transferability. They don't receive cash. They receive a defined benefit or tuition units under the current savings plan. They receive the number of units that they purchased. It's a defined benefit. Just really quickly, if they want to transfer it out and say they want to go to Stanford, we will cash out that program at a cash value of what our unit cost was at the time, give them a cash value, they take it, and they go to school wherever they want to. So there is you can always port the money around. Even though it wasn't addressed in the bill, that will be addressed, and that's, I think, standard practice in the industry to let them port their money around.
But, Michael, would there be any added value? Like, would they be accruing any interest?
Yeah. Senator Hess, very good question. I think some plans, and I don't know how many, but I think some plans say, okay, here's the value at our highest institution, plus they might give them a small rate of return. And that will be, I think, the board will do that by rule as well, if they want to provide a small rate of return. But remember, the price is based on the cost of tuition in the year that the tuition was purchased. Pricing models vary around the country, and there are a number of ways you can price these credits. You can price them at the highest cost of the university, which I think is what Washington does. You can do a weighted average. You can offer three different levels, say the highest, middle, and low. So there's a number of ways to get at this cost of tuition. I think our goal is, talking to my board, is let's make it as easy as possible for investors. And so however that needs to be, we can adjust these pricing models to make it easier for folks to understand. And I did want to definitely mention that the College Savings Board and the Higher Ed Board are going to work together on this. I know that we're going to try to offer an amendment that offers this rate-setting advisory committee made up of higher ed and our board, and I believe some members of the legislature, to help set the rates for the tuition credits. So the next part of this, then, the money goes into the trust and is invested. And this is where our program has a little bit of a unique or innovative feature. Since we don't have the backing of the full faith and credit of the state, but we want to make sure that we have some guarantee, we're going to build a guaranteed investment product with a firm, a large bank, or an institution to provide that guarantee. The guarantee has two important aspects. It gives families a peace of mind that they're going to get the money when their kids are ready to enroll, ready for college. But it also protects the university system, because we're going to there's going to be a floor so that if times are really poor and investment returns are down, the university system is always going to receive that floor of education. So that's where the guarantee kicks in and protects the university system in down years for those students. The guarantee also builds in a tuition inflation rate. So if tuition is $100, they're paying their premium, we're going to build in a tuition inflation rate so that we can pay the current cost of education when that student shows up at the doorstep. So a quick example is, it was mentioned that U of O over the last 10 years is about a 6.5% inflation rate. We might set our inflation rate at 7 or 7.5 to make sure that we're keeping up with those costs. We would likely do it, again, this is high level, on a 10-year rolling average of tuition so that we smooth out the highs and the lows. Again, the guarantee will be with a large bank or financial institution that can work with the state to build the product that we need for our investors. Some additional safety features that we want to build in, we're going to build in a reserve fund so that we have a fund there when times are bad. And again, you know, we all know times will get bad again. Building a reserve fund actually helps smooth out those times. We're going to properly price the units so that we meet the needs of investors but also meet the needs of the higher ed tuition rates. We have the ability to adjust that price every year, once a year, so that we can meet the cost of inflation over those of the times when tuition rises. And we're also going to put a five-year hold on the assets. So when you buy in, the money must stay in the fund for 5 years before you can access it and get the defined benefit. If you just want the cash value, that can be cashed out at any point in time. But if you want the defined benefit value, we're going to put a five-year hold on it. That keeps our premium levels down, and it also builds up the fund. So this slide, after the student requests tuition from the trust, the student presents those units to the school at time of enrollment. So they get them, we invest it, they get the units, they present them for tuition. And then the university, the trust pays the university system what we hope is 100% of tuition at the year of enrollment. But again, there's that floor, remember. So if we can't pay 100% of tuition, we will pay a large portion of tuition plus the inflation rate at the time of enrollment. And then last but not least, the ultimate goal is the student receives education and the student's able to graduate from college. Just some quick final thoughts. Prepaid tuition plans are, I think, intuitively simple to the investor. You're buying tuition at today's rates, which I think has a big deal nowadays with the market of 2008. A lot of families are looking for that guarantee, and I know that prepaid plans have not gotten a lot of assets over the past 5 or 6 years, as I think Betty can attest to, but the past couple years we've seen a lot of assets go into prepaid. And so offering that choice for families who just want to be risk averse can invest in a prepaid plan. So with that, I will turn it over to Betty Lochner, who can give you real-world examples on the Washington program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betty Lochner. I'm the director of the Guaranteed Education Tuition Program, Washington State's 529 prepaid tuition program, just your neighbors to the north. And I commend you on your efforts towards finding another way to help families save for college. We're very proud of the GEP program. I'm going to spend a little bit of time on the benefits for families, how we remain fiscally sound, some policy considerations and the success of the program. I won't go into a lot of the technicalities. This enrollment kit has probably more information than you'd ever want to know about our program. Also in the back, we have our mass marketing brochure and a quick fact sheet and our legislative update that we gave during this legislative session that has a lot of quick information on how the program works. I'm happy to answer any questions if you have specific ones, but I want to, given the short time, I want to talk a little bit about what Michael asked me to focus on. I'll start with our success. We passed our bill in 1997, sounds like a familiar year to Oregon as well, and launched the program in the fall of 1998. We are in our 11th enrollment year, and I'm proud to say I've been with the program for 9 of those years. Our total accounts, right now we're at over 97,000 accounts. We expect to hit 100,000 by the end of our enrollment, which is March 31 this year. This year we're on target for our biggest enrollment year ever, over 12,000 new accounts, and a lot of that is families are running to safety. Savings plans are very popular when mutual funds are doing well, and a lot of families have seen a lot of disappointment in those plans, and so our rollovers from other plans are up 57% this year.
And we keep reading that the stock market now has fallen back to 1997.
Yeah. Odd coincidence. The numbers of students that have actually used our units, and we do sell on used units also, is over 13,000. We have students in all 50 states and in 5 foreign countries. The amount we've paid out to date is $114 million. The fund balance is managed by the Washington State Investment Board. The current value is just over $1 billion, and that includes future payments on accounts, like Michael was talking about, the lump sum payments and also the custom payments where you finance over time. So that number includes money expected on those accounts that are being paid over time. And our investment portfolio, which is managed by the SIB, includes about 34% in U.S. equity, 45% in TIPS, which is why we haven't been hit as hard. Our fund is down about 20%, but many funds are, as you know, 30-40%. We have about 17% in international equity and the balance of about 4% in cash. The program is self-sustaining. We receive no state funds. The first year of the program, we received a startup fund and paid that off, and now we're completely self-sustaining by the participants in the program. The benefits to our participants. They're guaranteed that their investments will keep up with tuition inflation, and we do have a full faith and credit guarantee from the state by statute. So it's a peace of mind program. Families put in money, and they're guaranteed that no matter when their child goes to college, they will have the current value of tuition at that time. We are priced and valued at the highest Washington school, which is the University of Washington and Washington State. Whatever they're charging that year, that's what the payout would be. If you would have invested in our program the first year it started, you would have seen a 77% return on your investment because that's how much tuition has gone up in that amount of time. As tuition increases, the earning in the GET accounts are tax-free, which is the 529 tax, if used for educational purposes. If you take it out and use it for something else, you have state penalties and also federal penalties, and you'll pay tax. Flexibility. Account owners can choose from several payment plans. Most of them Michael talked about. We have the lump sum. We have a custom monthly where you lock in a payment and pay over time. And it's completely portable, which you also talked about. they can be used at any college, just about any college in the nation, and in some foreign schools. And you take the value of what's in your account, and you can use it anywhere. So if you have more, we sell by 100 units equals 1 year of tuition and fees. So if you have 100 units, that's the value we'd have. If you go to Harvard or out of state or Oregon, you would get that value to pay the difference. On the other side, if you went to one of our regional colleges or community technical, you may not need the whole 100 units, and you could use the balance for books, housing, other educational expenses, much like a savings plan. How it's priced: to remain fiscally sound, we're required by statute to have the program evaluated annually by a national actuary firm. We use Milliman out of Pennsylvania, and they've been with the program since inception. The unit price is based on an actuarial formula. It includes four major assumptions: future tuition, which our assumption is 7%, and that's the 20-year average in Washington State. Future investment returns, which is 6.55. Administrative costs, which is between $3 and $4 million, and a reserve balance. And that's to protect us from times like we're in now, when the funds are below what you need to pay out. We did have a similar experience in 2003 when investments went down and tuition in Washington State went up unexpectedly 16%, and our fund balance, we went through our reserve almost overnight. It took about 18 months to regain that reserve. Now, we expect it's going to take longer this time, but we absolutely expect to regain that value because it is a long-term investment. It's treated that way. The price can be changed twice a year, once in May, once in September. Due to the decrease in the stock market and increasing tuition, we expect at least a $10 increase on May. It will depend on tuition. We do have in statute that tuition stays at a 7% average through 2016, but as you probably are experiencing also, it's a tough budget year, and we may see tuition go up. If so, it will go up even more than that, because the 10% that I'm predicting is just based on investment results. So the other key piece, tuition, could change that. In 2003, again, when we had the other event, our tuition went up $10. We sold more units the next year than we did before, because I think people realize, oh my gosh, tuition's going up. We need to start thinking about it. And our whole goal and mission is to get families to think about it sooner rather than later, and not think about it in middle school, high school, but think about it when your kids are babies or even before, and start. You have more time to save, and you're going to save more money. Some policy considerations. Most of the participants of the GET program are from middle-income families. College rising faster than incomes and double than the rate of inflation, as you know. And in Washington, a four-year public degree will cost over $100,000 in about 18 years. Or for a child who's a newborn now, right now the current cost is about $30,000. So you can see as time goes on, as your other witnesses said, it just gets more and more expensive, and this program hedges against future debt. It's really what it's all about for middle-income families that can't pay as you go and are not going to get the free money. Without GET, many will not be able to attend college, be forced to take out even more student loans, which is, I think somebody stated, it's $18,000 to $20,000 per graduating student at UW and Washington State University. It sounds like that's pretty close to the national. GET also encourages families to begin saving for the child's future college education while they're still young. This reinforces in the minds of the child throughout their elementary years the importance of getting a college degree, while also teaching them it's better to save and prepay rather than borrow and spend. Washington's committed to increasing educational opportunities for its residents, and so has guaranteed the success of the GET program. The full faith and credit promise assures participants that GET is going to be there when they need it. The state also uses GET to distribute a number of its scholarship programs, including a GET Ready for Math program, College Bound, and our State Gear Up program. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay. Phil, did you want to
Mr. Chair, for the record, Phil Bentley with Senator Courtney's office. I'm primarily here just to answer questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
Questions of the panel? Senator Morse?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for coming.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
This is a real honor. My question would be, and there seems to be quite a difference between the Washington program and this proposal, in that this is not guaranteed, but yours is. If your program was not guaranteed, what impact would that have on your success in recruiting people to make an investment with the uncertainty of the outcome?
You know, I'm not sure. I know when the program started, I know there was a lot of consideration as to how to price it, and they decided to price it at the highest and guarantee that. I know there was a lot of talk of doing a weighted average or some other way so that that they wouldn't have to have the full faith and guarantee. I believe that when we sell the program, the full faith guarantee is important to families because they know. It sounds like your program is being set up in a similar way where they're not going to lose their money. And the difference is that, you know, our high tuition is probably going to go up a lot more than what your product might pay out at because you aren't pricing it at the highest and you're not guaranteeing it that way. But I know there's 19 prepaids out there. They're all priced differently. The ones that we've seen that are real successful have more of the backing by the legislature than others, and that's quite frankly I think one of the key elements because they have more control over the tuition setting and they're there behind the program all the way. So I think that's probably the first step. I also should say that I'm proud to say that we're the fourth fastest growing prepaid in the nation. You know, Florida's the big one that's been out there 10 years before everybody else, and then and that's by value of the trust fund and also number of accounts. So, you know, we're booming. We're going strong. We do not have a savings plan, mostly because we don't have an income tax, and we could not come up with a plan that was more cost-effective than our neighbors, and there was no reason to do that. So we only have the prepaid plans, so we also have that benefit of there's no competition and there's no real choice. If you want to buy the Washington plan, you buy GET. It also has a 2-year wait. I think Michael talked about a 5-year wait, which helps the fund. And it also, for us, you have to be a resident. The purchaser or the student named on the account has to be a resident at the time you open. So we could have a parent in Washington open for a student in Oregon, for example, or vice versa, which is a little bit different than many plans. So every plan is a little different, and I think that's important that you have the plan that works right for what you can do and what's right for your constituents.
Senator Westman. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on the previous question and Senator Morris's follow-up, and maybe the two bookends, or one of you might have the question answer, if not, we've kind of danced around the full faith and credit, and I'm understanding, you know, I'm reading between the lines. Do we have a constitutional problem with putting full faith and credit behind this program? Is that what we're saying that's different than Washington? Is there any way we can do that? I mean, we did the University of Oregon Stadium, and we have full faith and credit. If that doesn't go, I mean, you would think we could do college savings. Is there a legal issue here? Why we can't take that step?
You want me to take that one?
Well, go ahead.
Chair Haas, Senator Metzger, I mean, the full faith and credit requirement requires a constitutional amendment. That was the approach that we took in 1997, and that's why we went to the ballot. That's the distinction.
I mean, we cannot offer that without asking
exactly
citizens to put the full faith and credit.
That's correct.
It requires a vote of the people to put it on.
And if I can add, you know, our full faith and credit makes our legislators very nervous. You know, every year they're paying very close attention to this program because if we don't get the pricing right, they're on the hook. They have to pay. And, you know, we have $1 billion in the trust. It's a lot of money we're talking about. We're a very big program now. So it's very risky for the state. I mean, the risk is going to the state instead of more of the participants. So, I mean, it's a huge difference, and it's a lot harder to happen.
Ms. Lochner, I'm curious about whether you've seen more of the high school graduates in your state go to Washington universities because of this, or if that's been studied, or there's any effect at all.
Well, we have about 40% of our students that are using benefits are going to University of Washington or Washington State University. There's about 20% going out of state, so almost 80% are going to Washington schools anyway. But the most of them are going to the two research, and all we know is the data. I'm not really sure why.
Right. Well, many thanks for you coming down here and for you gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
We'll be in touch, as we said here, with work on this. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tom. Oh, Jim. And we'll move on to PE.
Thank you, Chair Haas, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Thomas Hojum. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Student Association. which represents more than 100,000 public post-secondary education students across the state of Oregon. Also, for the record, I'm not certifiably smart, so this will be a pretty quick, a relatively quick testimony crew today. I want to do two things with your time. First, I would like to go on the record as having thanked Treasurer Westland and President Courtney for prioritizing affordability for post-secondary education. It's something that students definitely have talked to me about and taken note. And they really see this as a positive signal for them as they try to finance their education. So they are thankful that this is something that the people that they elect are really focused on, kind of in a global sense. The second thing I'd like to do is to articulate for you the feedback I've got from them regarding this. It's going to be a little bit difficult because I guess you could say the position of the Oregon Student Association is still in a formative stage at this point. So I'll try to do that as concisely as possible. Students see this, they actually have the same concerns as Senator Bonamici did. They see this as a positive move for the state of Oregon, but they also did have the same concerns that this wouldn't help the Oregonians needed it most to get into college. Now, that doesn't mean that they're opposed, and I don't think they are opposed. So they just saw this as one more piece in a comprehensive approach to college affordability, and so they actually said that they wanted me to use this as an opportunity to talk about how this is what the Opportunity Grant was actually supposed to do, make college affordable for all Oregonians. And it is technically need-based aid, but it's one that takes into consideration, as I'm sure you mostly know, lots of factors that enable students to go to school. It fully funded, it would enable all Oregonians to afford college. Chair Hass, Senator Metzger, I'd like to address the issue you brought up earlier about how this would affect the Opportunity Grant. And what we would have to determine, and I mean we in a global sense, is that would this affect the EFC, that's the expected family contribution, and that's determined in the formulation of the FAFSA, would this affect that? And I do believe that, I mean, I'm fairly certain that a parent's assets are actually determined when that EFC is made. And when a larger EFC generally means a smaller affordability gap, which generally means a smaller grant. So that's what the students really, I've really heard from students, is that they do have concerns about what this would do to the Opportunity Grant. And they also have concerns that this might not take the spotlight off the Opportunity Grant as the primary focus for the state legislature to be making college affordable in Oregon. And you might hear more from me later as far as maybe a more definite position from the students, but that's what they're saying at this point. And I think that that's kind of mild concern, as Senator Cruz mentioned earlier. That's kind of the tone they have at this point. But and with that, I'll entertain any questions.
Well, thank you, Tom. I think you heard the sentiment that was raised here from our committee and some of the other speakers, that we understand that we're treating the symptom here until we can afford the cure, if you will.
And Chair, as members of the committee, the students do understand that as well, that ultimately it is a revenue and funding problem for the whole state. And so they're pretty patient about that.
Questions?
Thank you.
All right, I want to close the hearing on SB 7. And we're going to do three things all at once here in the remaining time here. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 643 and the informational meeting on implementation of PE, which is the requirements of the 2007 law. And my goal here is to incorporate some of that information into our bill that we pass over to Ways and Means. I hope we can vote on that today. And we do have people from out of town, and I want to make sure they get up here. And I know Don Zeron is here and has to leave. So why don't I call Don Zeron up first?
And, Mr. Chair, this will just take a second. He's coming up. SB 643 appropriates monies to the Department of Education for grants to school districts and public charter schools for PE. It does have a blank on it, and it does have a subsequent referral.
Good afternoon, Chairman House, members of the committee. My name is Don Zeron, and I'm a physical educator at Conestoga Middle School in the Beaverton School District. My qualifications for addressing the need to support Senate Bill 643 include a 35-year teaching career, both the elementary and middle school levels. I also served on the committee that wrote the state standards and benchmarks for physical education resulting from House Bill 3307 in 1997, and I currently am on the board of the Council for Children's Expanded Physical Education, a nonprofit which provides staff development opportunities for teachers. In 2007, the Oregon legislature courageously took a major step to remedy one of the more serious challenges we face in education, how to address the health and fitness needs of our students. Armed with current and irrefutable evidence regarding the epidemic of childhood obesity, the legislature passed House Bill 3141, which required students in K-8 to receive 150 and 225 minutes weekly of instructional physical education. The statute also requires that students be engaged in moderate to vigorous physical activity at least 50% of the time. The final bill had two important elements: a 10-year phase-in, which was a compromise involving impacted groups such as COSA, the OSBA, and the OEA, and a grant program designed to support districts in the acquisition of staff development or staff necessary to meet the law's requirements. Senate Bill 643 is designed to continue the investment school districts need to forge ahead in an effort to improve the health and fitness of Oregon students. The current deficit of resources devoted to instructional physical education is an insurmountable obstacle in meeting the requirements of the statute, especially when you consider the increased rigor expected of today's physical education programs. For many of us in this hearing room today, physical education was a very Darwinian experience, all about survival of the fittest, with endless time spent in lines waiting for our turn to throw a ball or shoot a hoop. The majority of the curriculum aligned with the popular team sports of the day. For those students that were not athletes, there was very little activity and even less relevance in these experiences. Today, PE is very different. MVPA, or moderate to vigorous physical activity, and lifetime activities are the themes of the day, and many of our schools have adopted PE curriculum designed to encourage lifelong participation using strategies designed to get students moving. Many school districts in Oregon have aligned their curriculum to the state standards and benchmarks and developed student learning targets and assessments that enable teachers to evaluate individual student progress. I have included some examples of the Beaverton assessments in your packet. A careful review of these tools reveals a level of complexity not found a generation ago. These are valid and reliable assessments that require a great deal of care on the part of the teacher and a great deal of time. Unfortunately, as the recent inventory of Oregon schools pointed out, there are too few teachers delivering PE to too many students to meet assessment expectations. My school in Beaverton is a perfect example. 20 years ago and prior to Measure 5, all of Beaverton's middle school age students had daily physical education with each teacher responsible for 150 students. I currently see 330 total students, each of them on an every other day basis. That equates to more than twice as many clients seen for half as many minutes. Add to these inadequacies the complexities of authentic and reliable assessment, and the need for additional resources becomes obvious. 4 months ago, before the Interim Ways and Means Committee, the Beaverton School Board Co-Chair Mary Vanderweel testified that Beaverton will need to invest more than $4 million to meet the staffing needs necessary to meet the minute standard. Districts like ours all across Oregon would benefit greatly from the continuance of the grant program as they try to be proactive in meeting the goal of full implementation by 2017. Support of Senate Bill 643 is the necessary and the right thing to do. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Don. Questions? Thank you for coming. Thank you for your work in the gym.
You bet. Thank you.
I know you have to leave, so
I appreciate,
you coming down here. I would like to call up our crew from Bend, if they're still here. Yeah, David Turnbull, Jamie Rock, who stepped out to run laps.
physical education teacher just sitting for this long and very
right.
difficult.
So I appreciate you coming over while you're getting set up. I invited the summit team over because of some news stories about conditioning that they're doing over there, which to me, I've always equated the difference being PE to conditioning more like probably pejoratively dodgeball to wind sprints.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we really want to get to fitness and fighting obesity, it's be interesting to hear where you're going.
Well, as we get ready for this, I appreciate the opportunity. For the record, I'm Dave Turnbull from Summit High School in Bend, Oregon, and my assistant here today is Jamie Brock. She'll be back momentarily. And we know that we are kind of short on time here, so we'll make sure we can get to things as quickly as we can. If I can find the PowerPoint on here.
Yeah, and we have a copy of this, so feel
yeah.
free to.
In fact,
and we have a copy of the colleagues. You have a copy of the news story in your packets.
Should it recognize as? As I said before, Dave Turnbull from Summit High School, to make sure we have that on the record. We started a conditioning program at Summit High School that was driven basically in a flurry of energy from me about 3 years ago. And it's responding to the same thing that we were previously talking about with the House bill, with the obesity rates in our country. And it's frustrated me that nationwide we've seen in some areas triple obesity rates, and it seems like the schools haven't been doing enough for it, and it's really come down to a lot of money issues. And I'll just start going as Jamie's not back here. What is the Summit model, the fitness conditioning program? This is a screening process for all students. We initiated it this year. Every single freshman that comes into our school gets assessed. What we do is we identify risk factors that lead to obesity, diabetes, other adult diseases that we've got right now. And we invite students to lower the risk factors. And so this is a voluntary program that the kids come through. We want to educate through positive relationships because as we're talking about body image, some of these kids are very sensitive, and moreover, their parents are more sensitive. We want to celebrate improvements with their fitness improvements, and we're having great success with it so far. The assessment. We did this in October of this year. The kids came in. They got their height and weight measured, as that allowed us to work with the BMI, which is the standard across the United States. We took their blood pressure. We had registered nurses come in and take their blood pressure. We measured their waist circumference, and we moved on to a recovery heart rate, which we followed basically a Harvard step test. And we tried to adjust that a little bit, as there is not a national standard for high school age students. So we had high levels of interest with the Ben Memorial Clinic initially when we started, because there's a lot of money tied into something like this. If you could develop a standard across the country for recovery heart rate for high school age students, there is a large amount of money that could be coming forward if you were to actually do that. It's not in place right now. And then we offered a nutrition and assessment survey that was online, and we've got some of the results that you see in front of you there. We also gave a brochure for the students that they could take home for their parents that explained the program. I'm going to let Jamie move on with the intervention process here.
Jamie, go ahead and start off with your name.
First of all, thanks for having me here, Senator Hass, sure. and committee members. My name is Jamie Brock. I am a health and physical educator at Summit High School and helped design and implement this program. As far as the intervention piece goes, once we had data, the kids kind of took a tracking sheet with them on that day, and we had several nurses and volunteers put in that information into a database, and then from this point we took high risks according to risk factors that were developed. We're able to contact high risk students notify them as well as their parents and invite them to visit with a registered nurse that we have on staff with us. And they were able to, then if they were encouraged to opt into a program, so it was an optional based, if they want to take part in this program, they could then set up a fitness plan. With that, they would be educated about nutrition. They would, there's an after school program that we have developed that they can take part in, or they are encouraged to take part in physical activities that we have within that. The whole point being that there would be a relationship so that kid would be invested in and have some time to improve their fitness nutrition. So we go from there.
One of the issues that we're working on right now is we're finding that a lot of our young kids, even if they can make the improvements at home, they'll go home and they don't necessarily have the parental support to continue their improvements. And so what we're working on right now, and this is really unique to the Summit model, the parents are going to get a free assessment at the Heart Institute of the Cascades scheduled for later on this month. So every parent of a freshman at Summit High School gets a free risk assessment. That's paid for through the foundation, Claire Choice Foundation, or Foundation One. They'll get their education. Part of the education process for them is brochures, grocery store tours to teach specifically some of our higher levels of poverty in our area. They just aren't educated as how to shop correctly for the foods that they need to eat. And they'll buy the cheapest, but if we educate them correctly, they will get good foods at a good price. Our nutrition classes will be coming up with a nutrition cookbook that the kids can take home and give to their parents that will give them healthy alternatives each day of the week. And then activities education for the parents, which will lead to lower stress for the parents, and that we'll be able to deal with their students in a more productive manner. We are developing a four-year plan at Summit. Each student completes a four-year plan. Our nurse would basically come in and talk to the kids in a classroom environment. So this is in their PE class, but we also bring them into the classroom to work on this. The plan includes tracking of activities for 4 years, 180 hours per school year. Fitness and activity goals are written each year based on a reassessment. And upon graduation, our student writes a reflection of the Summit model experience. Real quickly, I'd like to go through the roadblocks because we've got Madras High School who's going to implement the Summit model. There's a school in Medford interested in it, and we've been asked to speak to an 18-state committee this summer on the Summit model as it's getting national attention right now. One of the roadblocks is the perception of PE teachers. As our previous guest mentioned, your memory of PE is probably what my wife's is, which is why she hates PE to this day. Throughout the ball, you played dodgeball with things that can hurt, and it was a sport model. We don't want to throw out the ball. We know that that doesn't work. In education, in physical education in the United States right now, it's failing. It's failing because of perception. We have good teachers now, but the perception hasn't changed. We're considered a non-essential class. I have a conditioning class with 52 students right now. The teacher-to-student ratio doesn't allow you to really improve each individual. You become running at just a huge number of kids, and it's just not productive. The assumption is that we have coaches in there, not teachers. And we have seen that even at Summit High School. We are working very hard to change the model in which we teach to a more wellness-based model. But if you've got coaches in there that their priority is coaching, not teaching, that creates a problem. And money. The scale of this program is very large. When you consider 25% of our population is in need, it takes the equivalent of a full-time specialist to coordinate the model. Thank goodness we have the Heart Institute of the Cascades and the Claire Choice Foundation behind us, which gave us $15,000 to start. Further roadblocks. Parents. To trust a high school physical education teacher with body image, it takes a high level of trust. If we don't have a relationship with the parents, we won't be able to affect change. Being politically correct. We've been politically correct for so long that if you talk to a student about body image, you're calling them fat. And so we've got to be very, very aware of how we approach the students and the parents. The biggest issue we've had, the parents' past issues with their own body image, and it really upsets them when we're talking to their child about their level of weight and their health. And it's not the school's right to initiate change in a person's body image. We're running up against that already. Change, it's been this way for a long time, so we're working against some things here. Barriers, poverty, even at Summit High School, everybody considers we're the rich school. We have a lot of kids on free and reduced lunch, and they may not be able to get home. If they stick around for the Summit model after school, the conditioning program, they can't get home. So we've arranged with Bend Area Transit to pick them up after school. We're trying to remove those barriers. Time. Because these parents are poor, the kids are having to work. So right after school, they go to work at McDonald's. Unfortunately, what they're eating, and it's not a rip on our fast food, they're not getting healthy foods. Parental commitment. We started this at BMC a few years ago. We had 20 kids sign up, and after 2 weeks, we had one. Parents stopped bringing their kids. They don't have the time to do it. And another barrier. We have kids opting out. Online physical education. It further devalues physical education. And can you just say oxymoron? How can you have online physical education? Yet in our school district,
oh my God,
you can take PE online. That is wrong.
This kind of PE?
Exactly. And they just say they did it. Independent study PE, they can also do that. And we have a lot of our higher level academic students taking independent study PE. That doesn't quite work with No Child Left Behind. They have to have a highly qualified teacher. Who's to say the guy at the gym without any background in child psychology can act as a teacher? So we're not a big fan of that. And opting out should simply not be an option. Real quickly to close it, why is the Summit model needed? Obesity is the number one risk factor of heart disease and diabetes in our country. Weight-related issues are the number one contributing factor to our health care costs. The number one contributing factor. This is how we fix it. Today's generation is the first generation that the morbidity rates are reversed. Our kids are not expected to live as long as us. Obese adolescents are 70% more likely to become obese adults. If their parents are obese, this rate jumps to 80%. What can Oregon do? Increase the requirements of PE in high schools as well. The thing we'd like to see happen quickly, tied to the Summit model and the improvements we're seeing, is just do what Washington and California have been able to do. Increase those credits. See if we can get up to 2 credits. Highly qualified PE instructors. We do still have those coaches out there. So what we can do, we can require them to come to a seminar and training for health and physical educators instructed to revamp PE in their schools. Adopt a wellness model. PE classes have to adopt wellness models for us to effectively implement change. We can't put a volleyball net out there and expect every kid to take some benefit from that. Eventually require 4 years of activity. What we'd like to see is 2 years school-based activities and give them credit for being involved in cross-country or football or whatever, but so that they build a lifestyle change, not just a change that happens in class. 2 years of school-based education, 2 additional years of activity. And finally, is what we're working in our country, working right now. If we were failing in math and sciences as we are in health, there would be a public outcry. Physical fitness is our best life insurance. The quality of life says it when kids can't walk up a flight of stairs in our school without losing their breath. A community is known by the school it keeps. That's shameful. Because right now, if this is a reflection, we're not really doing anything, and I found this online. We know what is right. We just have to do it. Everything we want our young people to achieve is contingent upon their basic health. We have to stop treating PE as optional because it is as fundamental to the success of our students as reading, writing, and arithmetic. Doesn't matter how smart you are if you can't live to enjoy your intelligence. So that's a little background on what we're doing at Summit right now. We're getting great support on it with very little money, and we're going to continue doing it because, in the words of my great high school PE teacher, if it's best for kids, you just find a way to do it.
Okay. Appreciate you coming over here.
Thank you very much for your time.
Don't want to rush you through this.
You did a great job, actually.
We're trying to go quickly.
When the rubber hits the road or the track in this situation, what kinds of activities speak to conditioning as opposed to dodgeball or volleyball?
Well, you know it.
That you do that.
Initially, as part of our program right now, the kids that are involved right now, they've signed up basically because we pulled them in, and after school they're doing anything from, honestly, the best results we've had with a young lady, and I won't say her name, but she went from being shy and quiet, now she's singing the national anthem in front of the school. She's lost about 35 pounds. She just started by walking because we didn't have a lot of equipment to do things, but that's... I'm old school. You don't need a bunch of toys to improve your fitness. You can simply walk with an instructor, walk with somebody that cares about you, and pretty soon they're able to jog. The second student, that probably the biggest improvement we've seen so far, is a young lady that couldn't jog one lap when we started because she joined the track and couldn't.
She jogged
5 miles a day now. She's lost 40 pounds, and she's finally wearing jeans again, and she's so excited about it. And she now is a productive young lady in our society, and her family history is something that none of you would believe, and she's going to be the first one in her family to go to college and do some things. So self-image is vitally important, and unfortunately at the high school level, as you all know, if you're not confident in your body, it affects everything. And so we're trying to initiate some change with our kids and not focus on just the look. It's nice when the kids say, you know what, I feel great.
Thank you. Thanks so much for your presentation. I wondered if it would be possible to get a copy of your PowerPoint, because I was trying to watch it and I couldn't take notes.
I'm sorry, I was going so fast.
I just want to make a comment about, I'm glad you said that, something about how you focus on how the students feel, because I'm a parent of a teenage girl, and I know that there's a lot of problems with eating disorders with especially teenage girls and some boys. So I think that I know you're aware of that, but I want to make sure that that doesn't get lost in the you know, striving for everybody to look thin.
Yeah, thank you, Senator. As we started this program 3 years ago, we had one parent of a daughter who has anorexia, and actually one of our supporting sponsors jumped off as soon as they came in. They said, we can't deal with this because we're going to have parents come unglued. And in my heart of hearts, my wife works at the Cancer Treatment Center, and she said, you know, Dave, just because cancer doesn't cure, or just because our treatments don't cure everybody, doesn't mean we stop the treatment just because somebody died. You know, we address that. Here's the advantage of the Summit model. It doesn't just look at risk factors for overweight kids, for kids that have a risk factor for diabetes. We're also pulling in kids that are off the charts low. And so this is actually addressing that as well. But the key being relationships. You can't just pull a kid in and talk to them about their body image if they don't trust you. We've got to find a way to do this where you build the relationship first. And as we assess all the kids, at first it is a little scary because you got 400 kids coming through a gymnasium set up to do this. And I've got some pictures. I was going to load them on here, but I ran out of time. You can see the assessment, and we brought in some professionals to do this so that the kids weren't scared. And actually, they really appreciate it. And I think the problem is we are so, as I mentioned, the parents are the biggest hurdle for us. The parents have their own image issues. And so as they think we're putting kids on scales, you're going to put my kid on a scale? Yes, for baseline data. They're never even going to see it. And the one parent said, well, my kid's just going to get off and say I'm fat. And I asked her, I said, do they say that at home when they get off the scale? And she said, yes. I said, well, she's already got a body image issue. We're not doing anything about it. If you do nothing about a body image issue, it stays there. And so we have to address both sides of it. And it is difficult because being politically correct is, it kind of creates a roadblock for us sometimes. But because it's the right thing to do, we've moved forward and we're seeing huge improvements. But we are dealing with some parents that get upset with it. But that's part of the process. It's still best for kids.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Maybe Senator Bonamici, to answer your question a little bit more, we have talked about and wanted to implement, and we have our counselors on board as well to deal with some of those issues if we do see more risk factors for whether it's eating disorders or kind of the mental disorder, the mental side of this, that we have our counselors on board, and we've had several people from the health department, the mental health department here locally in Deschutes County that have been willing to and want to take part in any issues that may arise in that component, but it's kind of a big growing process, as we've mentioned, so it's one of the things that needs to be implemented within that program.
Thank you.
Well, thank you both.
Thank you so much.
We may have to lean on you before this is all done for some extra help. So.
All right. Thank you very much.
Dr. Cleveland? And I realize the time is quickly moving here, and we'll try to finish this and perhaps hold off our vote for another day, maybe incorporate the conditioning.
Did you all want the ODE folks now also, or
do you want to come up at the same time, Morgan? Morgan and Tanya.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education, and Tanya Friesendahl I've brought with me to go through our first interim PE report. And actually, Dr. Cleveland asked us if we wouldn't mind taking a couple minutes real quick to set him up. So if that's all right with you, we'll proceed. So just a quick reminder, and I'll keep my remarks very short. Back in 2007, the legislature passed House Bill 3141, which required by the 2017-18 school year that physical education instruction for our kindergarten through fifth graders be at least 150 minutes during each school week, and our middle schoolers, grades 6 to 8, would get at least 225 minutes of physical education instruction every week. Part of House Bill 3141 directed the Department of Education to award grants to school districts and public charter schools to help them meet these new requirements. We received a one-time authorization from the legislature to spend $860,000 off the top of the state school fund to distribute these grants. Again, we were authorized to distribute two types of grants. The first type of grant were grants to hire teachers who are licensed to teach in physical education, and nine school districts and 25 schools in those nine school districts received this type of grant to help hire PE instructors in their schools. The second type of grant we were authorized to provide to schools will allow them to do in-service training for their non-PE teachers to help them with physical education standards and academic standards and teach them sort of best practices. We awarded 12 schools and three school districts these types of grants, so we're starting to see an early return in investment on that, but that obviously just happened for one school year, and that's why I think the PE folks are back this time asking for some more resources so that the department can continue to award those grants and help our school districts prepare for the new PE requirements. The second part of House Bill 3141 required the department to collect data from school districts concerning the number of minutes, and I'm going to turn it over to Tanya Friesendahl, who actually did the report that we just passed out, and we'll give you a high-level overview of what's going on in our schools right now, and we'll turn it over to Dr. Cleveland and be available to answer questions.
Okay, Tanya.
Hi, I'm Tanya Friesendahl, the Health and PE Specialist at the Department of Education. On page 3, we're going to talk about, look at the physical education minutes, which was one of the components that we collected data on. And it talks about the number of minutes of physical education that are provided to students in kindergarten through grade 8 each school week in public schools. And we did an average by grade level. So kindergarten, on the average, gets 47 minutes per week. First grade, 73. And then the eighth grade gets 171. So you can progressively see that each grade level is getting slightly more. For the 2007-2008 school year, 35 K-5 schools, kindergarten through fifth grade schools, offered all students at the school 150 minutes or more of physical education instruction. And for the 2007-2008 school year, 96 6th through 8 schools or middle schools offered all students at the school 225 minutes or more of physical education. Next, we collected data on the physical capacity of schools to provide students kindergarten through grade 5 with at least 150 minutes of physical education during each school week, and grades 6 through 8 with at least 225 minutes. The first chart, Table 2, looks at the square footage of current facilities, excluding uncovered areas reported by the school districts for physical education instruction. Part of the data collection, if they had anything besides an uncovered area, they did not have to report uncovered areas. We were trying to get an idea of what schools only had uncovered areas and what schools had indoor areas, covered facilities to provide the instruction. So for the 2007-2008 school year, there were 34 kindergarten through fifth grade schools that offered all students the 150 minutes or more and did not need any additional facilities. And there were 91 6th through 8 schools that offered all students at the school 225 minutes or more and did not need any additional facilities. The third looked at the needed facilities. act so that schools could provide the physical education to meet the minute requirements if they felt that they needed additional facilities built. And so there were 42 districts reported the need for 174 additional facilities to meet the requirements of House Bill 3141. And there were 42 school districts reporting additional square footage that ranged from anywhere from 600 square feet to 54,400 square feet.
So, Mr. Chair, that was, we've compressed our presentation quite a bit in the interest of time, so we know you might have questions, but that is sort of that was our charge. We could share with you plenty of anecdotal stories. We've gotten great feedback from the districts. One anecdote to just share with you, Coos Bay received a grant for the PE teachers, and it was the first time they've had a full-time PE teacher in their school district, I believe, in over 20 years. So the investment that the legislature made during the last biennium has paid some great dividends in the first year, and so we have this sort of preliminary information to share with you. With that, we'll turn it over to Dr. Cleveland and be available to answer questions.
Bruce, yeah, question? Mr. Chair, just curiosity, from page 5, the table 3, does that mean that 113 school districts have adequate facilities to meet the requirement? Because I'm just doing the 42 plus 42 and subtracting that from the number of school districts we have. Would that be an accurate statement? Well, you have 42 school districts that report. Well, you have actually 42 and 42 school districts that don't have adequate facilities to meet the requirements. So would that mean that the rest of them do?
I would kind of caution, this is the first year of this data collection, and there was a lot of confusion at the district level exactly what we were asking for. And we literally were calling down to the school level to contact the principals so that we were trying to get as accurate a representation. But I feel that a lot of times the needed facilities may not have been included in reports because they didn't know square footage, because there wasn't funding, and so they just did not have the data to report.
Well, that's a significant issue. I mean, I just wouldn't, Ms. Chair, assume that this is the only fiscal need of plant need for the schools, that we may need more information on that.
And Senator Cruz, we would agree with that conclusion. Okay.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a brief question. I think it would be helpful, at least for me, to have on page 3 and 4, where you reference the number of schools rather than number of districts, I think it would be helpful to know the total number of schools, because I don't know how many middle schools and elementary schools there are. And you're talking about 35 schools and 96 schools. Out of how many would be really helpful? I know the percentage is going to be pretty low.
Chair Hassan, Senator Bonamici, I'm looking to see if Sasha Pollack, I actually got that data for, and I think Dr. Cleveland has that handy, so he can maybe address that. But if we don't get to your question, we have that data.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Chair Hassan, members of the committee, for this opportunity to testify before you. I really appreciate it. My name is Minette Cleveland. I'm a physician in the emergency department at Legacy Good Samaritan Hospital in Portland. I'm here representing PEAK, Physical Education for All Kids Coalition, and the American Heart Association. We're here to support Senate Bill 643 and Senator Courtney's continued efforts, ongoing efforts, to improve physical education in Oregon. I can assure you that I will summarize my testimony so it can be brief and be out of here before 5 o'clock, certainly. Well, I want to tell you, as a physician that's still in the clinical trenches of medicine, that I can tell you one thing. We're not going to be able to treat our way out of the obesity epidemic. We're just not going to be able to do it. We're not able to provide the care that we need to now, and we can't even pay for the care that we are providing. Oregon taxpayers are already footing the bill for $781 million of obesity-related health care costs each year, at least that amount. And unless we stem the inactivity and obesity and diabetes epidemics, it's only going to get a lot worse. One of our coalition partners, Regents Blue Cross, has provided information that's in your written testimony, just documenting how costly childhood obesity is in terms of both children's health and the fiscal impact. I won't go through those bullet points, but they're in the testimony. It's clear we must move upstream, focus more on health promotion and prevention, and one of the key ways to do that is to provide quality physical education for kids. Two key questions. Does PE really work? And where do we stand in terms of the implementation of the minute standard set in HB 3141? We heard a great, it sounds like a very exciting program at Summit High School that I want to talk to them a little more about. But do we have systematic or nationwide evidence that PE really works? Well, the good news is, in summary, is yes. CDC gives PE its highest recommendation as an intervention to increase physical activity, increases kids' activity and fitness levels, and increases the chances that they will become active adults. There are now 5 studies that show that decreasing physical education time does not improve academic performance. And there are even a few studies that show more PE time leads to increased performance on standardized tests and grades. So the evidence is now clear. PE works. It's a medicine that works both as a vaccine and as a treatment. But like any medicine, it doesn't work if it sits on the shelf. So for PE to work as medicine for our kids, they have to get quality physical education in sufficient doses. Which brings us to the minute standards. Back 12 years ago when we first came to Salem to advocate for quality PE, an education official, not someone in ODE, said, we treasure what we measure. Or we measure what we treasure. What's really valuable to us, that's what we measure. Unfortunately, as you heard early in the summit presentation, too often physical education has not been regarded as a core fundamental subject. So we haven't had much data on how much PE was actually being taught, let alone what percentage of kids are meeting the statewide standards in PE. In 2005, our coalition, with the help of the Heart Association, Nike, Oregon Sports Authority, chipped in to sponsor a small study to try and find out how much PE was actually being taught. A third of districts responded. It was a voluntary survey, and we found 93 minutes per week for elementary and 175 minutes for middle schools, still way below the current recommendations and in the bill. But it turns out we were wrong. Our report significantly overestimated how much PE kids are actually getting. The recently released ODE report makes that clear, and kudos to all the OD staff who I know have been working very hard to get this thing done. If you take the composite average of those of the 6 elementary school grade levels and the 3 middle school and add those together and average them out, it turns out that K through 5 students get on average 72 minutes per week, 48% of what's recommended in the bill of 150 minutes. Middle school students receive about 155 minutes per week, or 69% of that recommended 225. So 4% of K through 5 schools are meeting the minute standards. We can figure out what the denominator is, but 4% of the K through 5 schools are meeting the 150 minutes, and 17% of the middle schools are meeting the middle school standard 225. I've taken the liberty of creating a table at the bottom of page 2 of my testimony that lists the state averages for, as I gave in terms of the elementary and middle school minutes, what percentage that represents in terms of the minute standards. And then I think I've captured all of your respective school districts from members of the committee. So you can look on in the columns and see where your district stands compared to the state average in terms of minutes and percentage for both elementary and middle school. I call your attention also to the column called Days Lost, which I created. You know, that given the current budget situation, there have been painful discussions about the idea of cutting school days, and no one wants that. Wherever you stand on education issues, no one wants that, especially since, and I've gotten conflicting information, whether we have 172 days per year or 180 on average in Oregon, but I've made some calculations based on 172-day school year. Because, in fact, unfortunately, when it comes to PE, the school year's already been cut dramatically, and for years. Because if you think of a school that's offering 75 minutes per week of physical education on average for the year, that's really meeting half of the standard, so half the time. So in effect, kids are losing half of the school year in PE. Or if it's 172 days a year, that's 86 days that PE is effectively being cut. And again, based on those kind of calculations, you can kind of see where your own district stands. I also included data from Portland because Portland's the state's largest school district, and also because it has a high percentage of children on the free or reduced lunch program, which is a marker for lower socioeconomic status. 43.4% of Portland students are in that program. Unfortunately, Portland elementary school students don't receive the average of 75 minutes per week. They get 59 minutes, 18% less of PE instruction. And the middle school counterparts, not 155, but 105 minutes, 32% less than their less affluent counterparts. Well, unfortunately, this is consistent with one of the conclusions of our 2005 study, which was correct, which is it appears that the most disadvantaged students receive the least amount of physical education. So we believe PE is an issue of fundamental fairness and social justice. We must provide quality PE for all of our children, regardless of socioeconomic status. We took some very important steps forward in 2007 with the passage of HB 3141. And on behalf of the PE Coalition, I really urge you to consolidate those gains, pass this bill, consolidate support for this PE program and the inventory, and really recognize quality PE as a core subject in the higher education of Oregon children. I appreciate this opportunity to testify and happy to take any questions.
Dr. Cleveland, thank you so much, and thank you on behalf of all of us up here on what you do. I know this is a labor of love for you.
Thanks.
Questions?
Mr. Chair, for Senator Bonamici's question earlier that we get back to, 790 K-5 schools and 552 6-8 schools responded to our survey.
I'm sorry, Morgan, would you say that again?
790 K-5 schools and 552 6-8 schools. And I can get you some more numbers. There's some outliers because we have K-8 schools, we have some in smaller districts, we have some like 1-6 schools and things like that, but those are some pretty rough numbers to answer
Thank
your
you.
Question.
I think we've heard it a couple times here today that part of the problem with physical education or PE is just that perception that we all have from the old days of waiting in line, you know, beating each other in dodgeball. And just speculating here, maybe that's one of the reasons it tends to fall at the bottom of the list when you're ordering up priorities in school. And so we should talk about this as a committee and with the sponsors, but I'm just wondering if in this bill, and you're not here testifying per se, but whether we change the definition of physical education or call it something else. Maybe we call it conditioning or fitness activity or add a different phrase to it. Not that changing some lettering around will substitute for the money that's needed to do this, but I was just wondering on your thoughts on that.
Chair Hassan, members of the committee, I mean, it's really true. It's been one of the obstacles we've faced for a long time when we've been advocating for PE for now, over a decade now, is people not really understanding what goes on in PE. I mean, I know Don Zierung well. We've been in the trenches for a long time, and I know he and so many of his colleagues in PE are really focused on these lifetime skills, teaching aerobic conditioning, flexibility, and then part of what we do part of our job has been try to educate people about what PE is all about these days. I'm not sure about changing the name, but I think it's your comments point to the need for us to continue to educate about what really happens when PE specialists in there working with kids, because it's really remarkable when they get their chance.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, a lot of it's perception here. Dodgeball was a once in a great while activity, just kind of a fun thing to throw in. But I mean, I had PE all the way through school, and it was a structured curriculum.
Right, right.
And it included, like in middle school, we ran cross country. We did a wide variety of athletic activities. And I think it was physical education at the time, because we also had a segment of the curriculum that involved health. I mean, actual classroom activities. So I think that's kind of been carved out, I think, into another venue now. But you know, there is a, the perception may be wrong, but, you know, it was a defined curriculum. I noticed my middle school still has full-time, you know, Roseburg is way up there. So, you know, I guess I'm proud of that at 133%, no lost days. But part of the reason for that is the fact that we've had two middle schools in Roseburg forever, and the facilities are there.
Right.
So it's just been a continuation. It's not like they've had to add schools and reduce what you're doing in your new plant facility. So,
and Mr. Chair, I would hesitate to try to define physical education in the statute. I think the districts need to have some flexibility with, we need to have the ultimate goal, but have some flexibility there.
Well, physical education is already defined in law. In fact, it says on here, as established by ORS 329. I'm just wondering if we add to that definition or make special note of the conditioning or another way to perhaps hammer this home. And I didn't know what the education department thought of that.
Well, Mr. Chair, we're always happy to take direction from the legislature, as you well know. But just to kind of get to your earlier comment a little bit, you know, the discussion on PE, it's like so many things we discuss at this committee, whether it's arts education or music education or other things that because of, you know, budgetary situations, school districts are oftentimes forced to make difficult choices in things like physical education, the arts, you know, summer school, you know, outdoor school, things like athletics. Those things hit the chopping block first because we, you know, because of things like No Child Left Behind and state mandates, you know, that we test and districts are forced to direct resources to more academic programs. So it is a vicious cycle.
Okay. Perusing the definition of physical education.
It's not particularly instructive, Mr. Chair.
Yeah,
oh, this picture of guys playing dodgeball.
329, 426,
or 496. Well, thank you, Ray. And I know we have Katrina Hedberg here, and Sasha is back. Are you on standby, Sasha, or do you you want to testify?
Have any
okay,
definition
great.
Of what it is.
Why don't the two of you come up?
Defined. It should be defined.
Good afternoon, almost evening. It's my pleasure to be here. For the record, I'm Dr. Katrina Hedberg. I'm the interim state epidemiologist with the Oregon Public Health Division. And it is late, and so I'll just be very brief about my comments. And I'm really going to address the issue that we've talked about with the problem of obesity. You're all aware that this is a national epidemic, and we don't use that word loosely. Right now, over 60% of Oregon adults are overweight and obese. Our Oregon children aren't quite that high, but it's on the order of 25.9% of 8th graders and 23.2% of 11th graders are overweight or obese. So that's one in four. Obesity in and of itself, we've talked a lot about, or you've heard about body image today. From a public health perspective, we're really concerned about the diseases that this can contribute to. At a minimum, type 2 diabetes, which is something that we used to, it used to be called adult onset. It's no longer called that because we're seeing it increasingly among children. It can lead to, contribute to problems with asthma, high blood pressure, high cholesterol. Obviously, you know about heart disease as a classic result of obesity as well. And for the first time, we're now seeing that our this young generation of Oregonians is projected to have a shorter life expectancy than preceding generations, in large part because of the weight problem. I mentioned the overall proportion, about one in four. This number has tripled over the last 20 years, so this is something that is really an increasing problem. And I put some dollar amounts in there. That's really done looking at the disease and the impact that these various diseases have on our medical care system. And Dr. Minot, I think, addressed that a little bit as well. So simply put, obesity is a result of too many calories going in, and we're not here to address that today, although that's also a public health priority. But then not enough calories being expended. And we know that kids are increasingly spending time in front of computers, in front of TVs, text messaging. They spend spend 6 hours a day in school at a minimum. They're not getting out and running around the neighborhood in ways that some of us used to do when we were younger, which really supports the notion that they need to be learning life skills in school through physical education. I've included here the recommendations for kids, and again, I think that Dr. Minot addressed these already, so because our time is short, I think I'll close my testimony there. I'd be happy to answer any questions about it. But in sum, we really, in public health, we'd like to do whatever we can to address the obesity epidemic. I think that this physical education in school is one piece of a much more comprehensive approach we need to have, but nonetheless, physical education is a very important element of that struggle that we have. Thank you.
Doctor, thank you. Questions? Panel? I very much appreciate your patience in sitting through and listening to our difficulties in higher education, as well as our difficulties in funding physical education.
Yes. Mr. Chair, thank you very much, and I enjoyed the presentation from Summit High School, so I'm very happy to see that there are parts of our state that are schools that are able to tackle this problem.
Yeah. Sasha?
Senator Hatch, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sasha Pollack. I work for Senate President Peter Courtney, who would like to be here but unfortunately had to run off to another meeting. Senator Courtney wanted to make sure, as you all probably know, that physical education is a passion of his. He helped sponsor House Bill 3141, the report of which you heard today. And since I am not Senator Courtney, but I play him in committee, I will be giving you a few highlights of his testimony, which you have in front of you. I actually won't read from that, but a couple of things I did want to get on the record relate to that blank you see in the bill, which is not necessarily a policy decision as much as a Ways and Means decision, but I did want to throw out a couple of numbers. If we continue the grants that we have established, which were expected by those schools to be two-year grants, the amount in that would be approximately $860,000. $1,000. If we went for the whole hog and we're going to try to get every school up to the levels that we are expecting of them by 2017, that blank would look a little bit more like $10 million. So got a wide range of numbers to play with. Senator Courtney is very aware that in these tight budget times, this bill will rise and fall on its own merits, but he is very supportive of public physical education in the schools and wanted at least a policy discussion to be taking place, which he is appreciative has happened today. I can certainly answer any questions, but I think the folks that have come before me in, have certainly covered the field.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering, the sponsors of the bill are Senators Courtney and Devlin. Do you think they have any influence over the co-chairs? You don't have to answer that.
Sasha, thank you, and many thanks to the Senate President for his efforts on PE and physical fitness. Yeah. And probably in this context, we won't use the term whole hog.
Probably a good idea, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Cruz.
In the ORSs, there is no definition of physical education. There's just a requirement. And I think the requirement's necessary. I agree with Senator Bonamici that we need to allow flexibility at the district level for them to develop their own program. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought physical education is really a good term, because it's educating people on how to deal with their physical body. Mm-hmm. So it's really a pretty good term. It's just gotten a bad rap, potentially.
Thank you. Okay. Well, I will close. If there's no one else to testify on this bill, I will close the public hearing and the informational session. If there is no other business,
you don't want to move it, or do you?
I'm going to wait.
Okay.
Barring any amendments.
I think probably the others might like to participate.
I told them we wouldn't.
Okay. Cool.
Then we are adjourned.